In the years to come, as I worked closely with President Bush, I would come to believe that sometimes he convinces himself to believe what suits his needs at the moment. It is not unlike a witness in court who does not want to implicate himself in wrongdoing, but is also concerned about perjuring himself. So he says, "I do not recall." The witness knows no one can get into his head and prove it is not true, so this seems like a much safer course than actually lying. Bush, similarly, has a way of falling back on the hazy memory defense to protect himself from potential political embarrassment. Bush rationalizes it as being acceptable because he is not stating unequivocally anything that could be proven false. If something later is uncovered to show what he knew, then he can deny lying in his own mind. In other words, being evasive is not the same as lying in Bush's mind. The former is acceptable, but the latter is not. I've seen it happen during other private moments around people he trusted, as well as times during press availabilities and news conferences. Self-deceit is a human quality, and we all engage in it at times. But for politicians, it tends to be more discernible and probably more pronounced because of the intense spotlight they are under. Bush is certainly not the first or the last politician to deceive himself, but the extent to which he resorts to self-deception beyond personal matters, which one can argue should be off-limits anyway, and the sincerity with which he embraces self-deluding beliefs amount to a personality trait that goes directly to larger issues of character and leadership style and carry over into real issues of governance. Another memorable moment was the time late in the presidential campaign when it was revealed that Bush had been convicted for driving under the influence of alcohol during a stay at the family home in Kennebunkport when he was in his mid-20s. The momentum seemed to be with us in those final days, largely because Bush had essentially come out ahead during the 3 October debates. Bush had exceeded low expectations during the debates, whereas Gore had not met high expectations that he would decisively dominate Bush. Gore's first debate performance, marked by sighs and exaggerations, played right into our hands. A key message we'd developed to undermine Gore's credibility was that he would say or do anything to get elected. Gore did not let us down, as comments he made and actions he took frequently underscored that perception in many voters' minds. It contrasted well with one of our key underlying messages, that Bush was honest and could be trusted to do what was right, not what was politically most convenient. Now, 4 days before the election, Bush had just finished a rally in Chicago. I was heading toward the buses that would transport the traveling press corps back to our campaign plane when Karen told me that a local Fox News station in Maine would be reporting that evening that George W. Bush had been convicted of driving under the influence as a young man in his 20s. I immediately thought back to my conversation with Karen a year earlier when she'd said Governor Bush would prefer to avoid highlighting a law against drunken driving because of something in his past. Suddenly, Karen's words took on a specific meaning. Minutes after my conversation with Karen in Chicago, Carl Cameron, the national Fox News political correspondent who covered the campaign as a member of the traveling press corps, approached me, indicating he had heard the news too, I believe via the local station through his network. He told me he was going to air with it at the top of the approaching evening news hour with Britt Hume back in Washington. I contacted Dan Bartlett, who is our rapid response director back in Austin. One chief responsibility of the rapid response director is to keep close tabs on the opposition and find ways to put him or her on the defensive, such as pointing out when the opponent is saying one thing but has a history of doing the opposite. Another chief duty is to coordinate the campaign's efforts to quickly respond in the same news cycle to incoming attacks or damaging breaking news about its candidate. If it is an attack from an opponent, then the rapid response effort is usually aimed at counterpunching to avoid being put on the defensive. If it is damaging news, then the response usually tries to change the focus in the media, possibly by finding a way to frame it as nothing but a dirty trick from the opposition. I told him my efforts to hold off Cameron until we could get him some comment for the record were not proving successful. So Dan spoke with him and gave Cameron our initial response. It's an old political truism. A candidate who has something controversial in his past needs to get it out early and on his own terms. Otherwise, his opponents may choose the time and manner of its release, usually calculated to maximize the political damage. This is why smart campaign teams perform opposition research, OPPO, not just on their opponents, but on themselves, using public information sources as well as undercover investigations to find out the worst about their own candidate. After all, if we can discover embarrassing information about our candidate on the internet, in old newspaper files, or in public documents, the bad guys can discover it too. Everyone on the Bush team was aware of this principle, of course. I never had the impression that more than a few, if even that many, of Bush's top political advisors were aware of the DUI conviction. My conversation with Karen Hughes from a year before would lead me to believe that she had only a general sense of it, but did not know any specifics. My conclusion was based on knowing Karen and the vagueness of her language, something in his past. By the time we finished the final event of the evening, Bush knew he had to address the media feeding frenzy about the DUI story. Breaking so late in the campaign, this story had the potential to alter the race. All the rumors about Bush's wild days of young adulthood were dramatically resurfacing with specific, documented evidence. Bush told the assembled traveling press corps following his Wisconsin stop that the DUI story was, in essence, correct. "I've oftentimes said that years ago I made some mistakes," Bush said. "I occasionally drank too much. I did on that night. I was pulled over. I admitted to the policeman that I had been drinking. I paid the fine. I regretted that it happened. I learned my lesson." He had not disclosed the DUI conviction publicly before, he continued, because he did not want his daughters to know about it. He had told them as a dad not to drink and drive because he did not want them doing the things he had done. Bush went on to talk about the suspicious timing of the news break, raising questions about whether it was politically motivated. It was an attempt to shift the topic of conversation from Bush's own misdeeds to the behavior of the opposition in hopes that public revulsion against negative campaigning would produce a backlash against the Democrats. And indeed, a television reporter in Maine who first got the scoop later acknowledged that she'd been given the information by a local Democratic activist, a delegate to the Democratic National Convention. What impact did the DUI story have on the extraordinarily close 2000 election? It's hard to say. Karl Rove, George Bush's chief campaign strategist, believed the revelation was responsible for the Republican loss of Maine, where the news had originated, as well as the loss of enough support nationally to cost Bush the popular vote and send the election into overtime. By undermining Bush's campaign refrain about restoring honor and dignity to the White House, the revelation likely led some social conservatives to sit out the presidential race rather than cast a ballot for a candidate they now perceived as flawed. As for me, the DUI story didn't have much effect on my attitude toward George Bush or his presidential campaign. I'd signed on as a Bush supporter because I believed he could serve as a uniting force to help the nation overcome its bitter partisan divide, and I still felt that was true. I didn't consider the mishandling of the DUI case a serious misdemeanor on the part of George Bush, but a minor peccadillo driven by understandable motives, the desire to avoid political embarrassment over something personal from his past and a father's reluctance to expose a seamy episode from his past to his impressionable teenage daughters. Most important, the story did not reveal anything detrimental about Bush's ability to govern. The offense had occurred many years ago, and Bush had given up alcohol altogether more than a decade earlier. In any case, the crime had not involved violation of the public trust. Driving under the influence is serious and can lead to tragic consequences, but I don't think a single episode of DUI automatically disqualifies a person from public office, unlike crimes like bribery, embezzlement, or fraud, for example. However, there is an important political lesson that could have been applied to more important matters of governance later in his presidency. While Bush addressed the DUI story head-on and did so well, it was too little, too late, and on someone else's terms. He allowed it to become a greater controversy than it needed to be by not dealing with it early and on his terms. The result was that it added unnecessarily to the suspicions some had about his strength of character and future ability to lead as president. It would not be the last time Bush mishandled potential controversy. But the cases to come would involve the public trust, and the failure to deal with them early, directly, and head-on would lead to far greater suspicion and far more destructive partisan warfare. In any case, the election came down to the wire with the two candidates neck and neck, and as everyone knows, it led to one of the most contentious and protracted electoral battles in American history. My memories of the Florida recount, like my memories of the campaign, are a whirlwind. This time, a whirlwind of moving from county to county across central and southeast Florida to oversee on-the-ground communications efforts and make sure they were helping to inform and favorably shape public opinion. On election night, Bush led Gore in Florida by about 2,000 votes out of nearly 6 million cast. The extremely small margin triggered an automatic statewide recount under the state's election laws. Florida's 25 electoral votes would decide the contest, since neither Bush nor Gore had the necessary electoral votes without it. In addition to the automatic county-by-county machine recount, the Gore campaign decided to seek manual hand recounts of every ballot in a few select counties, and the legal battle that ensued over the constitutionality and fairness of the recount would drag on far longer than anyone expected. On the morning of day two of the extended election period, I walked into a communication strategy meeting to discuss the rhetorical warfare that was beginning between the campaigns. Dan Bartlett said, "We need more spokespeople on the ground in Florida. Any volunteers?" Whereas the Gore campaign had most of its paid communicators at the national headquarters or in Tallahassee, the state capital of Florida, one part of our communication strategy was aimed at spreading paid spokespeople out into select counties of interest. As a couple of hands went up, I thought to myself how worn out I was from traveling and how eagerly I'd been looking forward to a well-deserved rest. But a few more days on the road won't make much difference, I finally concluded. I raised my hand as well. By mid-afternoon, a handful of us spokespeople were on a private jet to be dropped off in different strategic locales around Florida.